Accession number 20126, Reel 3.
Thomas Avell, Reel 3. So what happened when you arrived in Mombasa?
Well, we stayed on the ship for about 2 days whilst the arrangement was made for our accommodation. There were about 20 of us, because some had been waiting to join the party, and it seemed I wasn't to be in Mombasa at all. I was to be at a place called Gilgil, up country, where the East African Artillery were forming their first units, of which I was to be one. And we went by, we stopped overnight for two or three nights at a beachside place near Mombasa, Nyali, I think it was called. And then we went by train to this Gilgil place, and it was a very basic encampment, tents. And there I was immediately made sergeant. It was the first time they'd had anyone qualified to look after vehicles, and so I couldn't go wrong there. And I suppose I had 6 or 8 months. The novelty was that the Askaris, the African troops who were being enlisted and trained, couldn't speak Swahili, which was the language of the country. But it really is only the language of the coast, or was then. And the African Askari soldiers who were being enlisted into the army for training had their own tribal language, and so they had the same amount of struggle as we did, because we were having to teach them using Swahili and they couldn't understand Swahili. But it worked out. We managed to somehow.
How did you learn Swahili?
I went on a crash course to a place called Jean's School in Nairobi for about 6 weeks, I think, and after that I could speak Swahili.
Is it a difficult language to learn?
No, not then. It was a question of having to learn it anyway. I mean, you imagine, I was given 12 men, first of all, to train as drivers, and I wanted to create driver instructors out of them to, you know, sort of pyramid business. And I didn't even know the Swahili word for stop, so I mean... But we won.
Did you have the choice of recruits? Were you able to pick and choose who you wanted to train?
Oh yes. Well, I used to go by physical stature. I mean, you didn't want someone who could hardly stand up straight or whatever. But the problem was that once we started had them driving, and they were speaking Swahili. Swahili is a very literal language. I mean, if you said to someone, stop the vehicle in front of that tree, they'd go and park it around the other side. Because if you put something in front of it, you're putting it beyond it. They're very literal. Little things like that. But the regiment I went to was the 304 East African Anti-Tank Regiment, they called it. And incidentally, there was a 301 and a 302 field regiments. And later on, we lost an entire regiment at sea, going from Mombasa to Chittagong. 302 regiment. The whole regiment was sunk, all on one ship, guns and everything. That's all on record.
What equipment did you have? You said it was anti-tank.
Initially, it was rubbish. It was a two-pounder anti-tank regiment. I mean, they'd bounce off a dustbin. They were quite useless. But they were all right for training. They were no good to go to war with. Later on, in Ceylon, we were equipped with six-pounder anti-tank, which were a lot better. And when the Americans came in, they produced one 57mm, same thing, £6 anti-tank. We didn't really need them because we didn't meet much in the way of armoured with the Japanese.
What accommodation were you in? You said tents initially. Did it change?
Well, we had buildings for the mess, the cookhouse and offices, but for the rest of it, it was all meds, all tents. Quite comfortable there. Just got used to it. Yeah.
What was the weather conditions like?
Marvellous, marvellous. Gilgil was about practically on the equator, but about 7,000 feet up. And it was, once you got used to the air, because I suppose it was short of oxygen, you couldn't do anything heavy, any exercise to any great degree until you were really acclimatized to it. Although there you are. We played rugby, I played rugby, and imagine playing rugby on the equator. And I was sufficiently acclimatized to be able to get used to it. And we play, anyone who came from anywhere else to play us, they hadn't got a hope. But that was that. Yes, Kenya is the sort of country one would like to go back to. It was good. I enjoyed that. I've never been back there, but perhaps it's changed.
So obviously there's a difference in the daily routine you would have had in the UK as to opposed to Kenya. What would you do in your daily routine there?
Well, if I was instructing, well, for a start with, one had a personal servant. So, I mean, there's no need to think about washing or ironing or cleaning out the tent or whatever. Most of our NCOs, and we had very few officers either, but the colonial chaps, people who came from white settlers who came from, say, Tanganyika or parts of Kenya, they were very friendly people. And I'm just trying to think. No, I've lost the thread of thought now. I was thinking about the...
You were going to say about the daily routine?
That's right, yes. I used to take 3 men with me, training at a time, driving, and taking it in turn. But there was nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, the system is the same with coloured people as it is with white. We had this language trouble all the time, but it was all right.
What vehicles were you training with?
The basic one was an American 3-tonner Chevrolet. Just a general purpose load carrier. And the roads were bad. They were sort of like corrugated iron. And so we were forever breaking springs and straining clutches and what have you. So I ran a workshop where I trained some African mechanics. They were very proud to be called mechanics. And I had quite a big workshop in the end. They were queuing up to be a part of it.
Is there any difference in the discipline between African troops and British troops?
Not really. I mean, you didn't beat an African. Shouldn't. No. The Africans seem to stick to them, their own tribes. They prefer it that way. And so I had one group who were Kamba, Kikamba. Yes. But I was only just passing to say that my own particular tribe was Wakamba. I had the most, but I knew a few words of most of them, which used to surprise them when you spoke to them in their own language. They used to get quite concerned. There's a sort of secrecy. Yeah.
Were they worried that you might have been listening to what they've been saying?
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, I went from Kenya to Ceylon by ship. Nothing peculiar about the ship, I can't even remember the name of it. And we went to Colombo first, and then I joined an independent unit, which is more or less a forerunner of the main East African force, which was to move over there to go into action.
Had you moved with all your weapons? Had you moved with all the guns and the vehicles?
Not to Ceylon. I'm just trying to think now. Now, the 101 East Independent Anti-Tank Battery was in Kenya. It was in Ceylon, doing jungle training and preparing the way for more African troops to come there. But we didn't have 2-pounders then, we had 6-pounders, British 6-pounders, that's right, yes. Because we had a firing range in Ceylon, which had a village in it, and we used to have to pay the villagers so much a day for getting out of the place for the day whilst we could fire across their land. Yeah, that's right.
When had you moved to Ceylon?
It must have been 43, beginning of 44.
So how long had you been in Kenya?
About 8 months, I think. Yeah. Long enough. I'm drying up a bit now. I'm just thinking. We went after jungle training in Kenya, in Ceylon, living pretty rough for a few months. I don't know how long. We got our new equipment and we went by sea then to Chittagong. Now, I'm not familiar about the broad layout of Burma. I can't place it now, but I know we marched from Chittagong and we were near the place that was run by the West Africans. You'd mentioned the West Africans, and the West Africans and the East Africans didn't get on at all. They just didn't, they were on a different wavelength. The West Africans were relatively educated and civilized. The East Africans were still jungle. And let's see, at that time, the Japs had been really overstretched because their lines of communication were such that they couldn't get supplies up, I don't think. What they were aiming for, as I understand it, was to breach the defences as far as the railhead at Dimapur and give themselves a toehold into India. But as far as they got, the last meaningful battle of any sort then was at Kohima. And we went down from Imapur, from Dimapur, we went to the railhead at Dimapur, we finished up there going by rail, that's right.
So you'd gone from Ceylon to Chittagong?
Yes.
And then on the railhead up to Dimapur?
That's right, yes. And that was where the Japs had been trying to get, but they couldn't. There was a nasty, nasty siege at Kohima for a few weeks. And we bypassed Kohima and got on the infall plane, not aeroplane, but we were supplied at the end when we first got there, we were supplied by airdrop. And we were there for quite some little time, I think, but then the monsoon was due, and I was very impressed because Lord Louis Mountbatten came down to speak to us from wherever he was. He'd been to Kohima because that was all sorted out. He came down to Imphal, and there weren't many of us, probably about 40 or 50 altogether, and he called us together and he told us exactly what he planned to do, which was the sort of man he was, I suppose. And anyway, it was the target was, apparently it wasn't customary to fight during the monsoon. You just held everything. But our task was to break out from Imphal, follow the Kabul Valley, which I shall never forget, down as far as the Chindwin.
Can I ask you about your arrival from Chittagong and moving to Dimapur?
Yeah.
How had you moved your equipment and yourselves?
We didn't have all of our equipment. Our equipment was shipped up by train. Well, we loaded it, and then we didn't see it again until we got to Dimapur.
So you took a more direct route?
Must have done.
Right. How did you move it down to Imphal?
By road.
Did you encounter any particular problems doing that?
The road was run by the Indians, LFC people, and they shifted personnel very well. The old three tonners again. I don't remember a great deal about that. My mind is fixed on the beginning of the Kabul Valley, and it was raining. And it rained for weeks and weeks. And this Kabul Valley was our target. The Japs were retreating down it. They stood now and again, but most of the time we were just mopping them up. And that's the worst time of my life, that. There wasn't a road as such, there was a track. And the Askaris, the Africans, were cutting small trees and bushes and whatever and laying it crossways across the track so the car could get a grip, so that the lorries could get a grip with their tyres. Those that had winches on were virtually winching themselves from tree to tree. I mean, it was impossible, but we did it. We went down there. And I've got all sorts of experiences remain of that, because, I mean, that's where we fought our little war. Yeah. The thing that comes to mind mostly is what we used to do at night, because this would probably tie in with others, with other people's same experiences, but we were all African. And when we stopped for the night, we were pushing down this valley. It's all downhill, and there were Japanese filtering through, trying to work their own way back as well, trying to get back to their own lines. But there were no lines as such. There was no front line. You were in pockets. And when we stopped for the night, or perhaps for 2 days maybe, ideally, we would find a piece of highest ground above the track and form a perimeter, put all of our vehicles and stuff that we didn't want to move in the middle, and the battery headquarters and what have you, and then make a perimeter encircling the whole of the encampment, as it were, but overlooking the track. And then we would take telephone wire and link it from to slit trenches on the outside of the perimeter. You'd have slit trenches at every, or probably about 30 feet, and between each slit trench would be a length of cable, so you had got a complete circle. And then you stood to at night and you stood to in the morning, because that's when things had happened. And if there was any movement outside the perimeter, you'd pull on your cable to the next chap, and he'd pull it to the next chap, no sound until everyone was alerted. This could happen in the middle of the night even. And then we had another system where, at the outer perimeter, we'd have a second cable suspended about this much off the ground, tin can with some pebbles in it, so that if in the night you were alerted and then you heard the pebbles rattle, you knew how near they were. And if you've got a clear space below you, as we usually had, then you didn't fire, you didn't give your position away, but you could let them have a grenade. I've got as many as three in one night from a bit of a bed. That one of them didn't die straight away. He made horrible noise all night. And some of them were offensive patrols. Some of them were just Japs trying to get back to their own lines. I know it's funny really, but there's one of them one night was shouting, Tommy, Tommy, we hear you. Tommy, Tommy, we hear you. And I was thinking that they think that's alerting our people. And we're all Africans. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. And of course, the danger was that if you didn't have a clear field of view to throw your grenade, you might bounce back towards near yourself. But on the whole, it was the only thing you could do. And this was night after night. Sometimes the Japs would have, quite a strong contingent. We never got hurt really much, but one of our mortar troops was really smashed up by Japanese one time.
So you would wait to hear a noise from the cannon, then how would you know where to throw your grenade? Just in the general direction?
General direction, yeah. But not where there's a tree where it might bounce back.
Would you clear a field of fire at all? Or?
Well, we used to usually, if there was a rise in the ground on the side of a track, you'd go up on that slope on the side and get yourself above the track. So preferably where there's two tracks joining, where tracks coming down, and you memorise in the daylight what is clear and what isn't clear, and if you've got anything on that track which made the noise, you let them have it. As I say, I got three in one night once, record. Sometimes you just get one, sometimes you get nothing, and they didn't know where you were. They only knew you were up there somewhere. But that was the perimeter defence, and I think it was adopted by other people afterwards. Two Divs said, I know a chap in Two Divs said that they'd started doing it, they'd heard what we were doing. Because they came alongside us. Well, the first British troops who got near us were the medium regiment artillery. 105mm, is it, or 155mm? I was never with them anyway, and they were useful. I remember there was a pagoda down in the river, and it was a very strong point, and we had a job to get past it, and this British unit, they got their OP up there, and they literally slit it. The entrance, they had these thick logs, the Japanese, right, I guess, and they literally parted the logs. Yeah.
They opened fire on the pagoda.
Oh yes, they used the pagoda as a mark. But I was nothing to do with that. I mean, that's just, well, I saw the pagoda and I saw what they did, and I was amazed at what good gunfire they produced. Mm.
Did you not have to use your anti-tank weapons at all?
Never. That's why we switched over almost entirely to the mortars, 3-inch mortars. Then we cut right down to about one troop of 57mm. Yeah.
And how did you manage to sleep during these nights?
In the daytime you slept. A couple of hours at a time.
Were you on the move all through the day, though?
I was, personally, yeah, because I was, the perimeter might be containing the battery headquarters of a particular section, and I would be going forward to our forward troops, looking after their vehicles, mostly jeeps, and I used to take the rations up to them as well, because the cooking was done in the perimeter section. Yeah.